session of May 4, 1977. For this last lecture of the year, I'd like to present a few brief meditations that will be about the whole corpus we surveyed. These two questions are first that of utopia and the problem of method or non-method. First, utopia. Initially, when I planned these lectures, I thought that the seminar on living together would be 13 seminars. You know, the College of France, you have to do 26 sessions. That's obliged. They can be separated in lectures and seminars. So imagine there would be 13 lectures. I've reduced the number of seminars. And I imagine 13 lectures. I imagine I would devote the last 13th to the building in front of you of a utopia of living together via idiorhythmy, since the lecture course started from that particular fantasy. In which case, if I had wanted to build this, I would have selected all the positive features from the dossiers we've been through, from the lifestyles of the very different subjects that feature in our corpus. I would have picked out all that I would have liked, all that would have given me pleasure. I would have then linked those traits together. I would have arranged them in such a way as to produce a quasi-novelistic fiction of living together. It would have been the living together of a group that's both contingent and anonymous. Also, if I could have constructed this utopia, I would have liked you to invite you to provide some elements, some snatches, some debris, some fragments of the figuration of an idiorhythmic community. It's increasingly my belief that one should encourage projective labor of a discourse, of a lecture course. That 13th lecture won't be taking place. At any rate, not as a lecture on utopia, at least under the pure subjective form I'd imagined. Why not? First, contingent reason that I cannot hide. I didn't have time enough to collect your contributions. And then, when it came to cheerfully constructing a happy utopia, I found I lacked the necessary enthusiasm. But also, there was a theoretical reason. That is this one. The utopia of idiorhythmic living together is not a social utopia. Now, from Plato to Fourier, all written utopias have been social utopias, from Plato to Fourier. That is to say, an attempt to define the ideal organization of power. Personally, I've often regretted the fact that there hasn't been, I've often felt a desire to write a domestic utopia, an ideal, happy manner of having a domestic utopia, a happy manner of figuring and anticipating the subject's optimum relation to affects, to the symbolic. But that, strictly speaking, is not a utopia. It's merely, or over above, excessively, the figurative search for the sovereign good. Hence, the movement of the drift of the lecture has been to describe the sovereign good as to living. Now, the sovereign good, in its figuration, mobilizes the whole of the subject in all its breadth and depth in his individuation, that is to say, in a personal history. A written utopia of a living together could only be in a written form. It would have to be a novel. Only writing, according to me, can collect all those forms. There is a connection between indirection of expression and the truth of a subject. Speech is both direct and theatrical. I'd say that to take my bearings in a recent book, and I can talk about it, the book on Fragments of a Lover's Discourse, and those who participated in that seminar will remember the book on the Lover's Discourse must have been richer as this seminar. But I consider the book to be truer than the seminar, even though it was not as rich as the seminar. Now, I'd like to be giving you some principles as to the idiorhythmic good. For the domestic utopia of living together. First principle, to recall or simply that Wilfred Rupprecht Bion, who has written this book, Experiences in Small Groups, Bion, has described the necessary conditions for a group to function. These are his conclusions. The necessary conditions for a small group to function well. What is needed is first a common purpose, overcoming an enemy, defending a common cause. The group must have an awareness of the limits of the group. Third, the group must be able to absorb new members or to lose members, that it should be flexible. Fourth, the group should not have any subgroups in it, subgroups with rigid boundaries. Fifth condition, each individual member has to feel valued and free. Sixth, the group must have a minimum three members. That's a minimum. To have interpersonal relationship. Two is only personal relationships. This corresponds with the popular belief that there's a qualitative threshold between two and three. Two is company, three is a crowd. Two is a couple, three is a group. This brings us to the problem of numbers. What is the optimal number? How can we imagine the optimal number of the members of an idiorhythmic group? We saw a few suggestions in connection with the idiorhythmies on Mount Athos. In the Ceylon monasteries, you have generally 10 resident monks. In the Buddhist version of life in a common group is very soft. In the Ceylon monasteries, you never have more than 10 resident monks. That would be an optimal number. In modern communes, hippies in the USA, there are between 20 or 30. In France, the same communities are around 15 people. My personal feeling is that these numbers very small by comparison with cenobitic monasteries are excessive. If I had to imagine or write a novel about a perfect community, if I was a legislator, I wouldn't go beyond 8 or 10. Third objective principle, we know that in ethology, the science of animals, in the most tightly knit animal groups, the least individualized, schools of fish, flocks of birds, the species that are the most gregarious always regulate inter-individual distance. They live all close to each other, but there is a critical distance. This would be the most important problem of living together. How to identify and regulate that critical distance? What does it mean, the critical distance? It's a distance on either side of which a crisis can occur. On one side or the other of it. One should never forget the etymology. krisis in Greek is connected to crisis. Literary criticism, one should always remember that it is also about crises, or to provoke a crisis. This is a parenthesis. The problem of critical distance is all the more acute today in our industrialized world of so-called consumer society. What's most precious, expensive, our ultimate possession, is space. Houses, in apartments, in trains, in planes, lectures, seminars. The supreme good, the luxury, is to have space around you. This is the most expensive. To have around oneself just a few people, not too many. This is the characteristic problem of idiorhythmy. If were we to imagine an up-to-date version of the monastic rule, it would look like this. In Saint Benedict's rule, the abbot provides each monk inserted in the community with a set of objects: a cowl, a tunic, shoes, stockings, a belt, a knife, an awl, a needle, a handkerchief, and a few slates. You have here a gift of objects allocated on the basis of needs, the necessary minimum. At that time, what was costly, what was provided, were manufactured objects. This is a simple rule of historic economy. The real standard of riches. In the 18th century, all the economic studies have consisted in bringing back to the manufacturing of mirrors, a whole day of work for a worker. The manufactured object is what is given here. In a consumer society, it cannot be the same. The object cannot be the standard. Objects today are too easy to acquire or to produce. One cannot imagine them to be given as a consecration. A knife, scissors, and so on, that wouldn't work. What is given today are not objects, but space. What you can give that's the most precious to somebody is to give him room. In a perfect rule, the main thing would be to give space. Fourth, objective principle, distance between the members of the community has a certain value. This value should not be considered from the simple, selfish perspective of reserve, quant à soi. I remind you that Nietzsche makes distance a very strong, a very rare value. I quote. It sounds provocative. The chasm, the abyss between man and man, between one class and another, the multiplicity of types, the will to be oneself and to distinguish oneself, that in fact I call the pathos of distance, is proper to all strong ages. The utopian tension comes from this. What is desired, I'd say, in the idiorhythmic fantasy is a distance that won't destroy affect. It will not make affect uniform either. Pathos of distance is a beautiful expression. It's something that's almost impossible to achieve. It has an element of tenderness. Pathos belongs to Eros and to Sophia. This could call up what Plato was saying under the name of sophronisteri. It's like planister and phanister. The sophronisteri mean that somebody is sophron, moderate, wise, combining Eros and Sophia. To finish with those remarks on utopia, we would go back to these remarks I was mentioning about tact, delicacy. Delicatesse, to live together but with distance and respect. That would be tact, to be accomplished without heaviness, without weight, but with warmth. The principle of tact would be not to direct the other, not to manipulate the other, to actively renounce images, the images we have of each other, to avoid anything that might feed the imaginary of the relation. Everything that can make a living together lighter, this is properly the utopia, the strict image of the sovereign good. Love without image, a perfect relationship. This is about utopia. Now, about method. And what about method? Interrogation point. Those who were here at the first meeting will remember that I began by recalling one of Nietzsche's oppositions. Deleuze mentioned that in his book on Nietzsche, the opposition between method and paideia, culture. Method is the good will of the thinker. a premeditated decision. A direct means deliberately chosen to obtain the desired truth, desired result. Everywhere it finds itself, method fetishizes the goal as a privileged place to the detriment of other possible places. Against that, paideia. It's an eccentric path of possibilities, exploring. Paideia consists in stumbling among blocks of knowledge. Clearly, we've not been positioning ourselves on the side of method, but on that of paideia. But, or to put it more prudently and provisionally, on the side of non-method. What this entails is a change of mindset, opting for one mindset over another. The method entails a phallic mindset. The constant reference to method, the will to method, entail, I'd say, a phallic psychic attitude. As the words will, decision, premeditation, going straight ahead imply. The non-method implies a mindset of a journey of extreme mutability, like flitting, gleaning. We're not following a path, we're presenting findings, and we go along as we go along. Is this a hysterical structure? I'm not sure. I could easily think this if hysteria, one of the effects of hysteria, is to create a certain fright, stage fright. In all those lectures where I practiced my non-method, I had a lot of stage fright. And I was on the side of hysteria. When I say I present to you, it's I exhibit myself, I expose myself. Hence, a lot of stage fright. And there is the hysterics question, what am I worth? Not no method then, but anyway, a protocol when it comes to the presentation of our findings. We have been gleaning, so we'll have a sort of treasure in the end. The protocol here, it seems to me, can be summed up in 5 points. First, the problems of traits, figures, boxes. I repeat myself a bit. It was in the work immediately preceding this, in the lover's discourse. I had the figures of a discourse. The figures, like those I have offered this year, they were not to be understood in the rhetorical sense, but more in the gymnastic sense. In Greek, schema. We shouldn't translate schema by scheme. It's not a design. It's not a plan of action. In Greek, the schema is a gesture, a bodily gesture, like the gestures of the athlete, the orator, of statues in action. The athlete in action. This was schema. Each figure is not a scheme, but the figures that we have seen, surveyed, refer to the movement of somebody at work, not thinking of the end result. Hence, two consequences. First, we can put in place by schemata some boxes, themes, topics, boxes. We have a space of the boxes. We are close to a topic, which is a grid of places to be discussed. It means that whenever you have a box, it's up to each of you to fill them in. It's a sort of game a game we play with many people. Like the game in which a ring is being passed among the players, or other games, or you could have a puzzle. In this case, I would just be the maker, the artisan, who cuts out the pieces of wood. And you, if you accept, you are the players. You put them together. You put together those boxes, the whole set will obey a principle of non-exhaustivity. The production of a figure will not be exhaustive. It can be endlessly completed. And there is a list of the figures, but it is not exhaustive. I'd go further, perhaps as a way of exonerating myself. I could say that the ideal lecture series, for me, ideas that come to me slowly, it might be a class in which the professor would be more banal than his audience. What the speaker would say would be less interesting than what the auditors would have to say. This banal position would allow you to say something of more consequence than what the lecturer proposes. I say this without any coquetry. What I have said was extremely banal. especially about the confined woman of Poitiers. I might have dealt with it more intelligently. I felt this without any guilt that I was being very banal. If a lecture course is a symphony of propositions, then each proposition will have to be incomplete. Otherwise, it's not a proposition. If it is not a little banal, if not a little weak, it is a position. That is to say, a phallic occupation of the ideal space. The dream in that lecture course would be a kind of non-oppressive, aerated banality, like what we've seen with tact. The second consequence is that there is a vague allegory in the figure of living together. I've tried 14 times to come as close to it. And I've just given a little spot of this, a drop of that, a glimmer of that. One doesn't really know where it's leading. This technique would call up the schools in painting, Tachism, Divisionism, Pointillism. The principle is a juxtaposition of colors directly on the canvas instead of mixing them on the palette. This is what I've done. I've juxtaposed my figures instead of mixing them up at home. At the end, it's a painting, but here. This is it? It stops here?